Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Ahmed Mazmi from Princeton University.
And I'm your co-host, Fatma Tariq from NYU.
Today we are here to talk to Professor Becky Schultes about her out-of-the-press book, Channeling Moroccanness, Language and the Media of Sociality, published by Fordham University Press just this year. Dr. Becky Schultes is an associate professor of anthropology at Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey. She is trained as a linguistic anthropologist with areas of interest including Arabic language ideologies, graphic sensibilities, social media discourse, and more recently, human-plant semiotic ideologies. She has previously co-edited with Donnelly Bowen and Evelyn Early the third edition of Everyday Life in the Muslim Middle East, published by Indiana University Press in 2014. Today's book, Channeling Moroccanness, by discussing it, we will explore the question of the book, which is, what does it mean to connect as a people through mass media? This book approaches that question by exploring how Moroccans engage communicative failure as they seek to shape social and political relations in urban Fez. Over the last decade, laments of language and media failure in Fez have focused not just on social relations that used to be and have been lost, but also on what ought to be and had yet to be realized. Such laments have transpired in a range of communication channels, from objects such as devotional prayer beads and remote controls to interactional forms such as storytelling, dress styles, and orthography, to media platforms like television news, religious stations, or WhatsApp group chats. Channeling Moroccanness examines these laments as ways of speaking that created Moroccanness, the feeling of participating in the ongoing formations of Moroccan relationality. Rather than featuring the discourse about Morocco's conflict between liberal, secularist, and religious conservatives, this ethnography shows the subtle range of ideologies and practices evoked in Fassi homes to calibrate Moroccan sociality and political consciousness. Welcome, Becky, to New Books in Anthropology, and thank you so much for joining the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the book. It's always a pleasure.
We would like to start. The pleasure is ours. We usually start the podcast by learning more about the author before we learn about the book. If you can say a few words about yourself, that is, where you grew up, where you went to school, how you became interested in your field of study, and if you would like to mention any scholars or books that shaped your thinking.
Sure. So I'm kind of an outlier in my family. I grew up on a dairy farm in the Western United States, and milked a lot of cows and did a lot of farm life. But I was an avid reader as a child. had a passion for and a fascination with the peoples of the Middle East, even from a very young age. I don't know why. I guess I can thank my small high school library and later study abroad programs for really fostering that. But I knew very early on that I wanted to spend time in the Middle East. And so I did study abroad in Jerusalem as an undergrad. I did an archaeological field school in Syria, worked for a Palestinian NGO in Nazareth, and then later worked for the American Institute for Maghreb Studies in the early part of my PhD that allowed me to go to Oran, Wahran, Jazair, Algeria, and Tangier, Morocco, as a part of my work. So I was able to experience a lot of different contexts and ended up doing, of course, my ethnographic fieldwork in Morocco. Part of my trajectory was very much influenced by Arabic sociolinguists that I learned Arabic under. Both of the people I studied Arabic with were sociolinguists. And that really shaped my understanding. And I really didn't know much about anthropology until as an MA student, I had done a historical MA. And I was asked while doing that MA to teach the Middle East section of an intercultural anthropology course. And that's what led me to linguistic anthropology. I realized very early on, at least while I was teaching that class, that linguistic anthropology was really where I wanted to direct myself. I loved anthropology. I loved the opportunity to get into everyday experience and to really understand the world through everyday experience. And I loved the way that the focus on language and semiotics more broadly, sign systems, really helped me to get at that. I really can't name names because if I do, I'm going to leave someone out. I've been really influenced by so many people. I did my doctorate at the University of Arizona under Norma Mendoza-Denton and Jane Hill and Tad Parks. And it was just a really great opportunity to learn from some pretty fantastic scholars. And they introduced me to other scholars who have really shaped my thinking. The book is really, really influenced by the work of Paul Kockelman, Laura Ahern, Michael Silverstein, Bambi Shefflin, Steve Caton. I could go on and on and on. I mean, I don't even know how many scholars I could. I mean, there's lots cited, but like I said, if I name names, I'm going to leave people out. So I really have been heavily influenced by so many people. That's the beauty of linguistic anthropology as a discipline, is that it's people are very generous with their ideas and with feedback. And I've really been able to learn so much from so many great scholars.
That's beautiful. And I remember you, just a disclaimer, Becky Ashley is my former advisor during my master's studies at Rutgers. And I remember us going to the Linguistic Anthropology Conference at UPenn, and I've witnessed the collegiality that you're talking about. That's wonderful. So let's now turn to the book and its chapters. A little bit about the architecture of the book. The book, as an ethnography, is quite engaging. You have these beautiful, what you call episodes, which quite fitting for, you know, the media you're talking about, that runs through the book. And after that, we have the scholarly part in which we analyze and dig deep into these ethnographic encounters and vignettes. The book is also richly illustrated. We have these beautiful images of graffitis, of signs, of the richness of the linguiscape, as you call it, of Fez. And then at the end of the book, we also have the transcripts. And I appreciate that for someone who is interested in language. That's going to be very useful to read the transcripts at the end of the book to get a gist of the sort of groundwork you've done for writing this book. So in the book, you also share your positionality. Your subjectivity is quite present as an ethnographer. And I honestly felt that I'm sitting in that living room while you are observing the family that you are observing and taking your field notes and talking about spreading the le vache qui rit cheese and olive oil and all of that. It got me also hungry. So thank you for all of that. I know that for your graduate training, you've also worked on Lebanon in addition to Morocco, and you've been working on Morocco for the last decade or so. And the book is really accumulation, and it shows actually in the book of that long process of engagement with Morocco and Moroccanness. If you can tell us a bit more about the research process, what it's like for you to conduct an ethnography that engages what people consume in terms of media, but also their lived linguistic practices.
Sure. So I'm continuing to learn even at this stage of my career. It did take me a long time to publish the book, partly because it took me a long time to really process what I learned when I did my doctoral fieldwork. And a lot of the chapters that end up in the book are actually from subsequent fieldwork that expanded on things I had learned during the year that I spent in Morocco and the year I spent in Lebanon. So I would say when it comes to ethnography, it takes time. It's just a process of time. And it takes a time both to write observations, but also takes time to situate them, to analyze them, to understand them better. I go back and look at field notes and I understand them in a very different light, even now, because of my continued engagement with the populations that I've been working with. So to me, ethnography is always process. And it, even though the book is published, that work is ongoing, as probably Fatima can attest, given her own interests. Ethnography is just a process. We do have to publish, but those books are unfinished, and they lead to other things. So to me, the field work is always ongoing, and that is the best part of academic life for me, is the opportunity to learn from people. To learn from the people that I interact with. So as you can tell, I started out the project as a dissertation project, and it evolved and emerged out of just spending time with people. I went over to improve my Arabic to Morocco in 2000 and in the summer of 2000, and then ended up going back and back and back, and was just fascinated with the ways that people engaged media and the ways that language was such an integral part of that. And ethnography just allowed me the opportunity to spend time. And I recorded interactions, but I also audio and video recorded, but I also just wrote notes, lots and lots of notes that helped me situate things that were happening all around me. And my notes are from all kinds of places, taxi cab rides, from fancy meals, like wedding meals, to everyday lunches or dinners, or even kaskarot, right? The tea time that is so important in Morocco, in Moroccan homes, I should say. So ethnography is just a process, and the things I observe come out of that process.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate the mundaneness of your observations. It really captures the I don't want to say the cliche, but really the everyday life of those people, and really give us sort of a rare view into their worlds. A little bit more about the ethnography, and more specifically the sub-discipline that you engage in the book. You've stated in the book on page 6, my training is in linguistic anthropology, which assumes that communication is always about something other than referring to things as they are in the world. So for our listeners who are unfamiliar with this sub-discipline, can you introduce the listeners briefly to it, and how does your book engages and contribute to it?
Sure. So I am as you noted, trained as a linguistic anthropologist, which means that I am interested in the connections between language and social life. And to me, language, despite the kind of key Euro-American ideology that language is about communicating denotationally, which means to give labels to things as they are, right? To just communicate things as they are. In linguistic anthropology, we assume that there are other functions of language. That language is about doing social work. And that social work is what I try to explore in the book. We have a technical term for the kinds of social work that happens. We call that, one of the key terms that we use is indexicality or iconicity. We talk about kind of different functions, right? Different modes through which social work gets done that isn't just about spoken signs, but also about gestures and objects and graphic forms, as I mentioned. And so all of those things are what I explore in the book. I'm not just interested, to me, language is much broader than just spoken or written forms. Language, because it always co-occurs with other signs, involves bodily comportment. It involves clothing. It involves, as you will read in the book, the prayer motions, right? It involves all kinds of things that co-occur with spoken and written forms. It involves fonts and colors, and it involves all kinds of signs. And all of those are pointing to social practice and to social ideologies and to social connections or disconnections, as the case may be.
Indeed. That was very useful introduction, a crash course in the field. So let's talk about the organization of the book. The book consists of 5 chapters. And within them, as I've mentioned, there are numerous episodes that share fascinating ethnographic encounters. In each chapter, you introduce, as you wrote, laments about communicative channel failures that precipitated Moroccanness projects by the state and several Farsi collaborations of those Moroccanness efforts. In your introduction, you anticipate the question of why have you focused on relationality, that is Moroccanness, this specific national relationality. And why investigating what I think is really a cool way of thinking about it, productive failures to think about this relationality. So I guess my question is, how have longing and loss expressions acted as collaborations of Moroccanness, media ideologies and communicative ideologies?
Sure. So I came up with the term Moroccanness because I didn't like the idea, the term Moroccan identity. Identity, as it has been discussed within psychology and even within anthropology, has really been about individualness. And I wanted to get at relatedness, not at kind of individual psychology, but about the connections between things and between peoples. And so that's why I came up with the term Moroccanness, which is, as you nicely put and described, my notion for relationality, for how people connect, what are the forms of their connections. And to me, I found it fascinating over the decade that I've worked in Morocco, how much people lament changes. But they do so not just to be despairing. Instead, they lament it because it's an active work of trying to change the way that Moroccans connect, the way that they relate. And the connections through media are so pervasive. And so, at least in the imaginary of the people that I was working with in their lives, they saw media as being such a profound influencer of their connectedness, of their Moroccanness. Oftentimes lamenting that it was such a failure, right? That public media, transnational media, that media mediating forms were corrupting forms of Moroccanness and sociality that had been in the past, or that they wanted to be in the future, that they desired or aspired to for Moroccans. And so that really shapes the whole form of the book, is this longing, this lament that serves as work, right? It is very productive. People on all sides of political spectrum are lamenting the failures of connection in Morocco. And they're doing so in order to shape and to influence the directionality of the future connectedness. And that was really what drove my analysis in the book.
Thank you, Becky, for that personal introduction and a little bit about the introduction of the book. Going into the first chapter, multilingualism was something that I felt was very connected to this idea of Moroccanness. And in the first chapter, you discuss the Fassi linguiscape. Can you introduce maybe Fez to the listeners, and what are the kind of sociolinguistic contours of Fez and its linguistic communities? I'd love if you could talk a little more about the way Fassis are very aware of the linguistic markers of different registers. You mentioned Jebli, Old Fassi, and Fassi Koine. I was wondering, in the case of the Fassi family, where all three registers were spoken, I wondered, do speaking practices at some point, do you think, become a personal choice as distinct social markers, or are they more so a result of different socialization processes?
Thank you. All very good questions. So I would say, first of all, that the attention to linguistic difference, right, and the social work that that does is not just something that happens for Fassis, right? I happen to do my field work in Fez, but Moroccans all across the country are constantly attending to the linguistic markers of difference. And those differences, as you know, I marked them as kind of geographic, but they're also social, right? The difference between Old Fassi and the kind of more Fassi Koine, or the generalized way of speaking in Fez. They're about aspirational differences and about class differences, although Fassis don't really talk about class that much. Moroccans in general don't. But they are about social difference, however that gets marked, and as I describe in the book. And those come out in encounters, right? They emerge in encounters, which means that the repertoires of the Fassis that I interacted with were quite broad. They could evoke all kinds of Arabics, all kinds of different ways of speaking French, and even forms of English, as you are studying currently, Fatima, but also different kinds of Spanish. And because Fez is such an attracting place for tourism, depending on people's backgrounds, they could engage all different ways of speaking in terms of languages, in terms of registers, but also in terms of different forms of Arabic and different forms of French, as I mentioned. So there's just a lot of linguistic diversity going on in Fez, and people are attuned to that, and they mark how those distinctions position each other. But they're very context specific. So as I mentioned, there's an encounter I observed in one family where the mother was from Jebala, which is up in the north, and the father was from the old city of Fez, but he didn't speak using that old city, which are very kind of iconic markers of being from very old Fassi families that grew up in the Medina, in the old city. He didn't use those. He used more of the kind of urban register that is across all of Morocco, but with very specific forms that are, again, a marker of urban Fez, but not the Medina. But he could use those Medina markers, and he did quite regularly, depending on who he was talking to. So he would joke about it with his wife on occasion, or he would, when speaking with his brother, he would use it quite often, because his brother, who also grew up in the same household, chose to use those as his marker of identity. So sometimes they are very consistently a marker of identity, but oftentimes those differences, right, are about situations and interactions, and people can invoke them in order to make a connection. So even though the children of this family I speak about in that chapter grew up in Fez and all speak the urban Koine, the Fesi Koine, when they encountered somebody who was Jabala, because they had heard their mother speak and they'd spent time in that area with their extended family, they could switch to Ghibli and in order to make that connection or to in order to create a bond, a phatic bond with someone in those instances. So, and at the same time, when they met somebody who was from the old Medina, they could switch into the old Fassi and connect through those terms. And it wasn't a sustained register, but it was enough to create that sense of connectedness. And so that was a very common thing for people to be able to do, is to switch even little bits and pieces of their way of speaking to make a connection.
Mm-hmm. And I remember that what they call the participant framework, I guess. That's really fascinating that you can capture all of this richness by just observing the way people present themselves linguistically. Moving to chapter two, literate listening, broadcasting news and ideologies of reasoning, which is a fascinating chapter I really recommend and I really enjoyed. What are the news talk registers in Fez that you examine in this chapter? And what are the Moroccans' framing of literacy, illiteracy, comprehension, and of course, Moroccanness by observing the news talk and other discourses of literacy?
So I started the chapter with a quote that is, and it comes from Open Society report that said that most Moroccans could not engage the news because they were not literate enough to understand it. And as you mentioned, the news in Morocco is presented in Fusha, which is the standard that is used across the Arabic-speaking world. It's a very formal register that almost everyone learns in school. It's not something that people speak on a daily basis, for the most part. It's certainly not a conversational register. It's very much tied to formal institutions and settings. It is the standard Arabic that is used across the region. The news is primarily in that, or it's in standard French, or it's in Amazigh, one of the Amazigh varieties, Tamazight, Tarafit, or Tashalhit, depending on the time of the day. But in all of these instances, it's a very formal register. And because one doesn't actually acquire these, with the exception of the Amazigh languages, through everyday interactions, the assumption is that you have to have gone to school in order to understand the news. And the assumption is that most people don't, that the literacy is, that schooling is so poor in Morocco right now that people just aren't learning the languages well enough to understand the news. My experience with watching people watch the news was not that at all. What I saw emerging was a counter narrative about literacy, that literacy isn't an individual skill, right? A set of skills that are acquired by an individual, but rather the pooling of shared resources, right? In interactional settings. So families would, and this occurred in cafes too, but I didn't spend much time in cafes. I spent most of my time in homes. People would just sit around together and they would share their linguistic resources to comment on and to evaluate and to assess what was being talked about in the news. They would sometimes summarize it, but oftentimes they would just share their resources, what they had, with each other, just commenting about it. And in the process of evaluating what was being talked about, they would actually transfer what was being talked about. So I came up with this concept of distributed literacy, right? This notion that literacy is not just an individual skill, but something that can be shared based on different notions of literacy, which are not tied to formal schooling, but can be tied to things like religious training in Quranic recitation, or tied to interactions. L'ihtikak is one of the concepts that the Fessies, some of the Fessies that I worked with talked about. This way of learning moral reasoning through interaction with people, through literally the rubbing together of people, right? Of their through interaction, this generative friction that can actually occur when you interact with people of all different backgrounds. And so these concepts, al-ihtikak and distributed literacy, were what was actually happening in interpretive moments and with regard to the news. So that people who had zero formal education were some of the most avid news watchers I knew, and were able to follow what was going on in the world, followed world events much more closely than I did, because of their interactions and not because of their formal schooling or their linguistic skills in standard Arabic or standard French.
Yeah, I found really interesting that notion of ihtikak and wa'i in the second chapter, and this idea that someone could be qari wa mashi wa'i, educated but unaware. And I love that you presented this the idea of distributed literacy as a challenge to this idea of literacy as just simply formal education, you know, the statistics that's constantly presented as so many Moroccans are illiterate, when Fassis constantly practice communal meaning making through cross conversations, when consuming media with family members, and critique as this powerful democratic tool that many of them used across literacy levels.
Yeah, everybody was engaging in critique. They were all critiquing each other. And it wasn't always a liberal notion of critique, right? It wasn't necessarily critique that was kind of progressive or open in any sense. It was critique that was democratic, but it wasn't liberal. And I think sometimes we confuse those two notions. I think there's a lot to be said for engaging in critique that is perhaps non-liberal, but still democratic.
Indeed. And we learn more about actually how critically Moroccans have consumed the state media in chapter 3, registering media and remediating a register, Moroccan Morality Tales, which is a very cool chapter, I think, because it resonates with me growing up in the UAE and consuming sort of folkloric, so-called traditional retelling and embedding them with messages that are not consumed passively by the audience. So how did the Moroccan state media try to create, as you say, a shared Moroccanness around gender equity messaging through a revitalized speech style or socially significant register known as Hadr al-Mizan, which is rhyme prose associated with storytelling of generations past? If you can elaborate on this genre and how it has been employed as a sort of social engineering tool, you may say, in Morocco.
Sure. So I found this particular genre of programming fascinating. It predated my time, my initial fieldwork time. There's been a long tradition of what we call heritage TV, or Torath television, right? Which is taking of mythical tales or historical tales specific to Morocco or to the Arabic-speaking world, and taking them and retooling them for civic work, right? For civic values that the state wants to be transmitted to the population. And I found them fascinating, right? So the first encounter I had with these was a program called Alif Lam, which was a literacy program that was trying to reach out through television to older illiterates and younger kids who seemed not attracted by the schooling system to try to teach them standard Arabic. But it did so through these Moroccan tales, these morality tales. And it did so using this rhymed prose that was in Darija, right? It was in the Moroccan local way of speaking. Oftentimes, actually, the Darija that was spoken in these was oftentimes Marakshi because the main actress was, well, I mean, it was a mix of Kaza of from Marrakesh and Kaza because some of the actors and actresses who were involved in the creating of this were from that region, from those cities. But it still allowed for, after they would tell this morality tale, then they would retell it using specific Fusha forms, certain standard forms. And I found that fascinating that that one could use this Darija rhymed prose to try and teach standard literacy, but through a moral lens, and specifically always highlighting the role of these clever women. Qid Nisa was an example of that. The tricks of women, right? And it wasn't just Alif Lam, this literacy program. There were lots of films being produced by Moroccan producers that would be about the cleverness of women or about showing that that equality could be found even in these historical tales. And so I found this a fascinating process, right, of linking gender equity, which is very much a state project, a state civic project, linking gender equity to morality tales, but through a specific register, which is this rhymed prose, ken wayat maken fil qadima zaman, right? This very rhythmed way of introducing, almost we might call it storytelling speak, that allowed for a link to this older way of, you know, older people's moral storytelling, but linking it to a very modernist project of gender equity. And as you noted, in the book, I find that that wasn't always the message that people took away. People were so happy that the nostalgia, you know, they had this nostalgic association with this rhymed prose and with these moral tales. But what the producers were trying to convey in terms of gender equity was not always what the messaging that was picked up by the people watching it. They oftentimes were just happy to hear the rhymed prose, and they were more fascinated by the what we call the indexical feel of, right, the social connectedness to that moral past than they were into their, you know, the forms of speaking that were clever and tied to their grandparents than they were to anything else. They weren't as fascinated by the tales about gender equity or about promoting disability, right? Recognition of the equality of disabled persons. So it was a fascinating process to watch the way that the state was trying to mobilize this way of speaking, this register, but the ways that it failed to connect, at least among the Farsi families that I was working with.
Right, that nostalgia that was picked up by one of your interlocutors who didn't even watch the show, but expressed the same nostalgia for that kind of speaking with rhyme and rhythm that older generations were able to do, and the deep morality that was kind of denoted by that type of speech was fascinating. And it resonated with the overall theme of like this lament and communicative failures, which was seen in the last chapter through the failure of like TV due to connect people due to lack of access. And it's something, it reminded me of like how intentionality versus like what the state intended, mm-hmm. right, with the show. And then the uptake is what really is important for us as linguistic anthropologists. How people understand and relate to the message.
Yeah, that oftentimes the message is not, the uptake is just very different from what the producers intended. And that is the beauty of ethnography, is that you get a sense of the disconnect, or I would say the the difference of connection, because they were still connecting. They were just connecting on a level that the state wasn't necessarily as interested in.
Mm-hmm. Moving to the soundscape in Fez in chapter 4, scripting sounds and sounding scripts, which is a lovely title, senses, channels, and their discontents. So if somebody listens to you now, he would think, how did Moroccan Arabic come to be politically charged to this extent? And what were, as you say, the overlapping partial and fractional language ideologies that permeated representational diversity in publicly circulated forms of Moroccan language usage? If you can shed light on the linguistic representations of Moroccan Arabics, and what does that tell us about channeling Moroccanness?
Sure. So one of the key formations of Moroccan nationalism has been Arabic as a unifier, right? But in this case, the state, as all Arabic-speaking states, chose standard Arabic, Fusha, as the kind of key unifying medium of nationalism, at least on paper, constitutionally. But in practice, people were connecting and unifying around Darija, which is why we call it, right, Moroccan Arabic in English. Arabic is tied to nationalism in specific ways, but it's usually not the standard. And so there's a tension between this formalizing, centralizing role of standardness and the heterogeneity of dialect, right, of Darija, of the ways that people actually use language. And I was fascinated by the ways in which this isn't just an issue of orthographic, right, of writing styles. It's not just an issue of specific spoken forms. These are very interconnected, but we oftentimes write as if they're different. So in the literatures, the linguiscape is almost always about graphic forms or spoken forms, but rarely about the ways in which spoken forms are kind of evoking the tangibility or materiality of writtenness, of graphicness. And I wanted to think about that more, because that's the way that the Fassis that I worked with viewed things. It was very strange for them to see Darija written and to try and then reanimate that spokenly in a spoken form. And so I found that very fascinating. And I began to realize that that the connection between the embodiment of speaking and the embodiment of writing really needed to be explored better, especially in terms of modalities. So it was okay for Darija to be used in radio advertising, right? Because that was considered conversational and normal, but it was a very different, and it was even okay to do that, to write Darija in texting, because that was, again, attached to a modality that was mobile phones, right? Which were, again, more of a spoken entity. But when it became attached to newspaper writing, all of a sudden it was a very, very different political loading and social loading. And so I began to realize that modalities mattered for that embodiment of speaking and graphic forms. And so that's what I wanted to explore in this chapter, is the political loading of embodied ways of speaking, the multisensory aspect that is a part of being Moroccan. And it became very clear that published newspapers were problematic for writing Darija. It was seen as a challenge to state unification and state notions of Moroccanness, right, of connection. And those entities were oftentimes the newspapers or that used derija as a medium of expression, written derija as a medium of expression, used it to challenge the state politically on several issues. And so there was an indexical linking between resisting state authority and the writing in derija in newspapers. But that wasn't the case, for example, has become less so in advertisements or in chats or other modalities, other platforms. So that was part of what I was trying to explore, is the ways in which media platforms or mediums were politically and socially charged in terms of the graphic sonic forms that people encountered in them or used them for.
Right. I was particularly interested in the heterogeneity and even the orthographic forms of derija writing. Sometimes I noticed the letter that's in the Egyptian, like a gim sound, was kind of like, sometimes it was like a kaf with a line over it. Sometimes it had like the three dots, but it's just like, because people spoke the language, they would know. I would think it would be still easy to read because they know the word and the context, but it's interesting that it was still hard to read, even though it's such a, you would think it would be easier because it's spoken.
Yeah, and written derija is it's pointing to all different kinds of social embeddedness. So even in Morocco, there's differences in the way that people pronounce the forms, and they tried to find a graphic way to represent that. And so part of that was the heterogeneity that we saw in the writing of derija, of writing of Moroccan Arabic. There wasn't a policing of it. There's no standardness because it's not the standard. It's not the form people are supposed to write in. And so they can write it in any form they want. And that allowed them quite a range of identity work, right? A range of connectedness. This notion of heterogeneity allowed for, you could write and represent your ways of speaking in a lot of different ways because it wasn't the standard and it didn't need to be.
Mm-hmm. And in relation to this, I'm reminded of your journal article, I believe, Do You Speak Arabic? It's called, mm-hmm. If you can remind me of the title. It's a great read. It's about Arab Got Talent. Was it that show?
Arab Idol and I think...
Idol, yes.
Yeah, I think with Arab Idol. Well, there's a several of
them. Yeah, it was one of those talent shows, and it was about the linguistic confusions and orthographies, and it's just a fascinating read, I think, for a classroom. And I think the reader will benefit also from reading that article in connection to chapter 4. I'm really intrigued by the last chapter, chapter 5, and I'm really thankful that you've included this chapter in the book, because I feel it wouldn't be a complete sort of understanding of channeling Moroccanness without really including Islam and religiosity within that that production of Moroccanness. So chapter 5, Mediating Moroccan Muslims. What can the so-called Moroccan model of Islam that the strait projects tell us about the production and channeling of Moroccanness? Specifically, how do the people of Fez express their concerns about the channels by which Muslims learned and shared Islam? And what can that tell us about recognizability, right? The social recognizability of Moroccanness through the medium of Islam.
So I started my field work in Morocco right at the point where they had their wake-up call about forms of Islam that the state did not approve of. There was a bombing in Casablanca that killed a number of people that were all Muslims, right? They were Moroccan Muslims. And it was targeted again, you know, it was by what the state calls extremists. But not everybody believes they're extremists, right? There's a whole range of perspectives about what it means to be Muslim in Morocco. And the state was very concerned that they had lost the narrative on what it means to be an appropriate Muslim in Morocco after this event. And it's, of course, only blossomed since then, given the rise of Daesh and the Islamic State and other, right, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. There's a whole range of groups that are challenging the state's narrative about its authenticity in relationship to Islam. And so the state started to very much invest in the semiotics or the sign mechanisms of what it means to be a Moroccan Muslim, to connect as Moroccan Muslims, to relate as Moroccan Muslims. And part of that, of course, involved a foregrounding of very specific Moroccan signs of Islam, right? The form of the minaret, the orthography of Qurans. There's a Maghribi khat. There's a calligraphy that is very specific to Morocco that they print their Qurans in. And there's also what they call and this whole semiotic bundle, very specific mechanisms for prayer that were seen as kind of a marker of Moroccan of the Maliki school, which is one of the schools of Islamic thought, and that is connected to Morocco, that is, of course, promoted by the Moroccan government. And all of this became bundled into what they call the Namudij al-Maghribi al-Islami, this Moroccan model of Islam, or practice, we might say, of Islam, that allowed them to foreground the tolerance of Moroccanness in relationship to Islam. And the chapter explores that and the tensions that exist among Fesis who don't necessarily agree with some of the ways the state is promoting Moroccan forms of Islam, or not forms, Moroccan signs of Islam, right? The model of being a Muslim that connects to other Muslims within Morocco. And there was a lot of tension over that. And it came out when people were watching this or listening to the religious channels that were being promoted by the state. And that's what I explore in the chapter, is those tensions. And the chapter ends by looking at how that plays out even in one family, right? It's not even that families are socialized into particular ways. Even within a family, there are differences in how they perceive Muslim practice and its how that connects to other Muslims, or how it should connect. And there's a lament that, of course, Moroccans aren't as Muslim as they ought to be. And this, again, has precipitated this challenge of connectedness that I explore in that chapter.
Right. Taking a look at that example of that family at the end of the chapter, we once again see distributed literacy in the way they're kind of coming together to understand or take messages, I guess, from the religious program. And it's really comical, actually, like the way that the older brother makes it about gender relations and tries to kind of preach to the sister who the main message is like about predestination. And so once again, we see like that, the friction of contact is ihtikak.
You never know where it's going to go because it is generating friction, right?
Right.
And so even though the message from the state is about predestination, the way that the family took it up was in a very different manner, about gender roles, or even just, you know, I just want to watch and enjoy it. I don't want to have to worry about gender roles. I don't want to have to worry about predestination. Let's just enjoy being together in the family. And you get that feel as they keep riffing and teasing each other all the way through that interaction.
Yeah, it was very enjoyable to read. All right, so in conclusion, who would you like to read the book, and what would you like its impact to be? And if you can think of Moroccans, anthropologists, anyone interested in the scholarship, you engage as well as North Africa?
So I tried to make the book accessible to somebody who didn't know anything about North Africa or who didn't know anything about linguistic anthropology, but just had an interest in learning about how people connect through media. And the role that language has in that process. I'm hoping that it will be of interest to non-specialists. I tried to make it as accessible as possible. I hope that people outside of anthropology will read it to better understand how politics are super mundane, right? They play out in very, very mundane ways. They're not always about the big events. And how what seems to be very, very despairing, right? Laments, when we talk about laments, we think about them as being about sadness or about loss. But this book is actually very hopeful. This book is about how the feeling of loss can be super generative and productive in promoting social relations that are based on friction, based on not necessarily getting along, about agonism, but about an agonism that doesn't necessarily have to end in conflict.
That was beautiful. And okay, well, Becky, we've taken up a lot of your time. I'm wondering what you're working on now and if you can tell us about your current and future projects or what you hope to work on.
Sure. So I'm still working in Morocco. I'm a little bit broader than Fez at the moment. My current project is looking at phytocommunicability, which is about the kinds of ideologies about plant and human connectedness that shape all kinds of research and conservation and consumption projects in Morocco. And I'm probably about a third of the way through that book. I'm hoping to be able to get that book out shortly. I have a few articles out on that as well. But I'm also just interested more broadly in semiotic ideologies that have been shaping Arabic in general. So I've been going back and looking at old Materia Medica books. So I'm looking at pharmacological books to see how they are the kind of semiotic ideologies that are shaping Arabic notions about plant-human connectedness. So that's my new project.
Thank you for listening to today's episode, in which we explored channeling Moroccanness, language, and the media of sociality, published by Fordham University Press in 2021. This is your host, Ahmed Mazmi.
And your co-host, Fatma Tariq.
Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in Anthropology.